March 29, 2021, it's the Waffle Pedro Show. Pedro Show. Happy Monday. Last Monday for March. Almost a done deal. We start off with Every Time We Say Goodbye. John Coltrane live, November 29, 1961, and Sea Level with Lover. People, Brother Matt's at the Love Grotto on the Pleasure Point because we're still in Quentin Tarantino mode. But I'm not totally man alone because those software engineers in Estonia with their righteous Skype software. I got Coding David from Sea Level all the way from Cleveland. Welcome aboard.
How's it going? How's it going?
Well, how's it going? I'm doing this show and you're the guest.
It's pretty sweet. This doesn't get any cooler.
Yeah,
it's,
this is an honor to talk to you, Watt, and we just appreciate you having us on.
Okay. You know, did have a little bit before with David because of that benefit that and being on his show. That was months ago.
Right.
And I promised David that I would return the favor.
Well, thank you so much, man.
Greatly appreciate it. And I did listen to that episode, so I'm privy to everything that you guys talked about.
Yeah, well, that was his show. He ran it. I tried to be a good guest, Cody.
I thought you were. It was a very interesting and awesome episode for me as a listener to experience.
Okay, now you're a fucking guest also. Now let's get into your fucking journey through music. Cody, please bring me your earliest musical recollection.
Okay, my earliest musical recollection would be my first actual memory in life. When I was about 5 years old, my mom picked me up from kindergarten and took me to go meet Ozzy Osbourne.
Okay.
And that really is the earliest memory I have.
Did he sing for you?
He didn't, no, it was,
then
it
where
was like
the fucking music?
Well, I did see Black Sabbath on that reunion tour they did, or whatever, but yeah.
Okay. Look, it's a Watt for Pedro show. There are no hard questions, and there are no wrong answers. You're safe, Cody. Now, where was this? Was this Cleveland?
This was in Cleveland, yeah. It was at some mall. He did like a meet and greet.
Let me ask you. Well, forget that. You know, he's bad. You know, I saw them a couple times. When I saw Black Sabbath, he never stood in the middle. It was the guitar player. But anyway, back to your story and your music. In the pad you grew up there in Cleveland, was there any musical instruments?
Yeah, so my dad was kind of musical and had played guitar, but he was never like a trained musician. He was more of a self-taught guy. And he would, as opposed to like learning riffs, he would kind of just make up his own riffs. And he didn't really know chords. He kind of just did it his own way. And so I was inspired from that, and at a young age, around maybe 10 or so, I started to pick up the guitar, and that was the first instrument that I started playing on.
Well, that's why I'm going to ask you, because there's a guitar around, and your pop wasn't being creative on it. Did you jump on? And you did jump on. But before you jumped on, what about grade school? Were you in the fucking marching band or the choir, shit like that?
Yeah, I did. Actually, I played saxophone in grade school, was right around...
Which one?
It was tenor.
Wow, like John Coltrane.
Yeah, but it was actually around the same time that I was picking up guitar, so I was more interested in guitar and not as interested in saxophone.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
The sound of the saxophone blowing hard in a fuzz guitar.
Quite similar.
Yeah, I've always felt that. I've always fucking felt that. And you know, sax is real important to early rock and roll and before that R&B, right?
Totally, and it's one of my favorite instruments, but I feel like as a kid, it just didn't have the same sort of, like, appeal, because I said I met Ozzy Osbourne, so clearly I was coming from a heavy metal sort of young
background. Well, also, I got to imagine the material. You're probably playing shit for the school.
Yeah, they had just playing more, like, simple stuff, but I did do the talent show they had, I played Smoke on the Water on the saxophone and then set the saxophone down and picked up my guitar and played it on the guitar.
All right. And I guess you played the guitar part.
Because, yeah, I just played the one riff.
If you listen to that fucking song, Cody, not to cut you off or anything, but the bass guy, I think it was Robert Glover, right?
Yeah, Robert Glover.
I think he even wrote the fucking words.
Roger Glover.
Roger. And I think he's the second baseman. I think he wrote the words, too, just like Geezer did for Black Sabbath. Look, what was the first record you bought with your own money?
The first record I bought with my own money...
There's an echo in there.
It's hard to... It would have been some sort of metal record.
So you're into genre?
I was as a kid. Yeah, growing up now in Cleveland, it was real. My life was real genre based.
No,
so
everything was, man. That's what it was like when the record companies ran the show.
Totally.
Well, we grew out of that shit, right? Music is music. So what about the first gig you went to? It was probably that fucking Ozzy gig, right?
No, actually, the first gig I went to is kind of it was a cornier rock band of the time. They were called Stained. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, but my earliest memory was 5 years old meeting Ozzy.
Yeah, so I had met him, but I think that was like just a meet and greet, and then I actually saw Sabbath on their reunion tour, which was maybe like 6 months later or something like that.
Ah, so you saw in between that time a gig, okay?
Yeah, I saw a gig.
They're called Stained, huh?
Yeah, they're called Stained.
I know
Stained.
About the Stains. They were from East L.A., and they were a great band. They made an album for SST.
Yeah, no, this is not that type of music. This was more just like early 2000s radio rock.
Here we go, getting into types and genres again.
For sure. But the cool thing about that first gig experience was it was my birthday, and the guy took the time to sing happy birthday to me from on stage or whatever.
Fuck, how did he know you were there? How did he know it was your birthday?
My mom had made a cardboard sign that we wrote, it's my birthday.
Well put. Watt has, he's in his place now with a little pat on the top of his head. Okay, so what about this, Cody? Not after school, like graduate, but after school in the afternoon, and you get the garage band or the bedroom band or the basement band going. Did you do that?
Yeah, so the first band I did was kind of, like you said, just a garage band, and we were called Wasted Generation, and it was just a few of my friends. None of us really knew how to play our instruments, and I think we actually had all had instruments but wanted someone else in the band to play that instrument. So it was, but we never learned any songs or got past the garage at all.
It was just a practice. Learn songs. You were trying to copy off records or write your own?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. We were trying to copy off, like, I remember.
No, me and D. Boone did the same. There was no culture until the movement. Look, I want to play Burn Your Own Gasoline.
You know you have to call. Thank you. Thank you.
Wofford Pedro Show, that chunk of music started off at Sea Level from Seatown. Burn Your Own Gasoline. Dustin Wong after that, Inward, Outward, Skyward. Dustin Wong's got a brand new album. It's called Internal Hot Springs, and it's fucking bitching. It comes out this week, so check it out. This week. Fuck, Thursday's D. Boone's B Day. Tobacco after that from Pittsburgh, not far from you. Brand new album. He's got Everything Around the Knife, and it's fucking bitching. I love it. Marco Serrato and Raul Cantizano in Sevilla, Spain, Seville. They got a brand new album out. Everybody, yeah, springtime for album rock. Yeah. With Contravetta. Wharton's expanding jazz band, Wharton Tears. Cat, New York City. I got to record with him once with Bob Quine and Lee Rinaldo doing Bobby Dylan's Freeze Out. He's a beautiful band. He's got a new record. Morton's Exploding Jazz Band, Magic Sky, and there's people like Thirst and Glenn Branca and shit like that. Tommy Dahill from Alaska with Sylvain, for Sil Sylvain. We lost Brother Sil a couple months ago. Great, great cat. New York doll, man. Dirty Guitar Politics from Bombus Prendon. The Crevice Tool, Dirty Guitar Politics. Sounds like somebody's fucking got hiccups. Hands Rotten after that from Switzerland with Rakim Mars, Space Pack. And then finally, Backpack Train, Sea Level. So let's get over to David. David, your earliest musical recollection, please.
I think the earliest musical recollection I have is listening to, so my dad works construction. My dad and my grandpa own a company, and they're a two-man team, right? And is hearing blues records, just hearing B.B. King, hearing all the blues guys coming from the radio in their shop or the radio in their cars. So that would have to be the earliest music I can remember.
No, that's all right. That's all right. That's a good memory. And in the Pat, are you Seatown too? Are you Cleveland?
Yeah.
Okay, so in that pad, was there instruments?
No, there wasn't at first. Like, my grandpa played an accordion, and my dad always liked piano and blues guitar, right? And my brother eventually got a guitar, and my younger brother, and he worked on it for a couple years, and it kind of sat around. And that's when I picked it up. So I went over and was trying to figure it out, and, like, was trying to learn riffs from, like, the Blues Brothers film. Like, blues was a big deal at my house. So that's kind of like where it started.
What about school? Were you in the choir, the marching band, or shit like that?
I was in choir, and then I took general music, which is the kids that didn't want to be in choir or marching band. And, like, that was, like, around middle school, and that's when I really started falling into the guitar and trying to figure it out on my own. So I kind of dodged all the academic education.
Well, it doesn't
which
seem
I
like
fell into.
What I've noticed, David, is that there don't seem to be a lot of music when there is a music program, right? Some schools got rid of them. That's why I always ask that fucking question. But yeah. It seems like they never want to get into guitar much. Now, I've had guests where they did learn guitar in fucking elementary school and junior high and shit like you're talking. But usually it's brass. For some marching thing for the football game, right? Or it's like an orchestra, a band, a big band for school, either helping with a play or some kind of like assembly shit, right?
Yeah.
So what you do is you man up and go man alone.
Right. So I started picking at it myself.
You just like listen to records and try to copy.
Yeah. Doing the record thing and then like Tablature became a thing in high school. I'm like, oh, I can find someone else to try to figure it out. I can try to see if they figured it out, what I couldn't figure out.
Do you like that form? Do you like that form of talking?
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, it's always fucked up for me, you know. But the notes and staves are hard, too. What I got into was more just blocking off chords and bars and shit, but like cheat sheets, but... the tab, that's a hard way to implement licks and riffs.
Right.
And the tab is probably the best for maybe riffs if you don't know how to read notes and staves.
Right. Well, it goes back to like a lute music. It's as far as in music history, that's with stringed instruments, they would tab it out. So it's a old form, just like sheet music. But it, for stringed instruments, it makes sense, right? You, here's the fret, here's the where you put your finger. It, you know, it's a.
The problem but the problem is it don't carry no time weight.
Right, right. That is the only.
Yeah, that's really fucking lame.
You gotta learn how to do that.
Yeah. It doesn't tell you how that number five lasts. The number three lasts. So okay, yeah, maybe where you put your finger on the fucking string, but as far as like, anyway, look. They're just ways of trying to bring to another dimension, the actual dimension of performing it, right?
Right, right. That's when the listening comes, you know, okay, now you got rid of the physical thing. Where do I put my finger? And then you have to listen to it.
Right,
so it
and
helps,
maybe,
in a way,
maybe that helps develop the ear, though.
Right, it's kind of half and half. And I think it depends on the person, because, like, it is weird that with your comment on in school it's brass instruments and stuff, but those are expensive. Guitars
are
cheaper.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But
you want to know real expensive, David? Well, me and D Boomer boys, right? We're 13 in 1970. Keyboards,
right?
That's why we didn't know anybody who played them. Man, even a cheap like electric. I think Univox made the first electric that was like $400, which was like you could buy a Volkswagen.
Wow.
Gas for it.
Yeah.
Okay, so and that's why my theory, David, rock and roll went to the guitar because it was more kind of because rock and roll is actually a piano instrument.
Right. It's strung, right? And you're doing the same thing. There's just less strings and less you're supposed to three strings per note. You got one unless you got like a 12 string. But I just found it interesting because guitar is harder to do physically, maybe, than brass instruments, but it's way more affordable. You think
I don't know. I don't know. Here's the thing about stringed instrument. You put your finger, you hit the string, there's the note. With the fucking brass, a lot of that note comes from your fucking lip.
Yeah, you do got to really feel the the interval.
You notice the fucking bugle don't have fucking vowels.
Right. It's all in the ear, I guess. Yeah, that's
in the lip, lip, and also the tongue, the way the tongue gets in there and shit.
Right.
So look, they're all challenges, and they're all interesting. What about the fucking drummer who has to do 10 things at once? Georgie told me he was like balancing on his tailbone, and then pretending he was a fucking octopus. That's right. You got to carry all that shit, schlep, right? The big schlep. So, what about you, like Cody, after school with the garage band, basement band, bedroom band?
Yeah, so I did that for a little bit, but it wasn't really satisfactory. Where I ended up finding my musical, where I got into music more was once I started to go and venture out into open mic nights, and that's actually how I met Dave.
Yeah. So
I was going to get to that how you met, but so you left the band thinking you went for Man Alone, like singer-songwriter. So you started writing songs, or were you copying?
No, it was more so like the open mic scene around here was inviting to where they'd have a house band, and if you were a younger kid playing, say, guitar, you could get on stage and play with the house band and just go through a Jimi Hendrix tune or a Black Sabbath tune, whatever it may be. So it was just copying songs, but... So not to where you had to, like, go out all by yourself and
no,
just do
that. No, kind of like a hybrid karaoke.
Yeah, I guess that's it. They would call them open jam nights instead of open mic nights, and I guess that was the proper
term.
Instead
of the karaoke machine, you had the karaoke band. You know, I did that once with these guys. It's called punk rock karaoke, where we let these kids come up and sing, and then we would be the backup band for them. I did it
That's
for about
awesome.
A year. Yeah, with Steve Soto, a great cat, and Greg Hetson, and Derek O'Brien, and some of the guys from the hardcore Circle Jerks.
Nice, yeah.
But that's the idea of, and maybe that's what these backing guys did at your fucking open mic night. To see those kids get lit up by being the singer for a song was just fucking, a lot of the fucking, I don't know, spirit of the movement. Even though nothing was original there, but just the act that they got to come up stage and be in the band for a song.
Yeah, and it was definitely in a bar that was, like, we shouldn't have been in. Me and Dave were way too young to be there, but we were just accepted by everyone because we were the
kids. Did you see him play? What happened?
Yeah, so the first time I actually saw him play wasn't at that bar, but my mom was a bartender at this bar called the Phoenix. And Dave, it was called the Phoenix 2 because there was another one around, but it had nothing to do with the other one. But Dave would go up there and play, and my mom told me, you got to see this kid. He can play like Jimi Hendrix. And Dave was he's a few years older than me, so I think I was 13 and he was 16.
15.
And so I wasn't actually allowed to go to the bar, so I saw Dave play at this sort of like county fair type deal. It was called the Family Fun Fest, and it was basically Dave with the band from the open mic night doing the same sort of thing. But I remember the first thing I saw him play was Little Wing by Jimi Hendrix, and I was immediately like, I need to be in a band with this kid.
Okay, so what, you have a powwow?
Yeah, so I met him I don't think I met you that day. We had a powwow at an AC/DC cover band called Thunderstruck that played at the bar, and my mom let me come up to learn how to do sound. So I was actually there as like an interning sound man, and I met Dave that night, and we had a powwow, and then eventually I ended up sneaking up to the mic night on a night that my parents weren't up there and playing a song with Dave.
And it's like two guys on two guitars. There's no drummer, and there's no stick man.
No, yeah, there was a house band. So
well, no, no, no.
And, oh, yeah, yeah, just us two as far as, like, friends.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, so, like, when I was – I didn't do any music in school. I would do music out of school. So my dad would take me up to these blues jam nights because that's what I was learning. And so for a few years, I was just going up and sitting in with all these house bands and learning these rock and blues standards. And then some of the nights got shut down, and the Phoenix 2 – had a mic night, and then so I started to go there, and the guys were having this big AC/DC show. I go to check it out, and I met Cody, and we didn't play in since.
Oh, man. Yeah, end of the first hour, March 29, 2021, Wofford Peters, so special guests, Cody and Dave from Sea Level. Hold tight for hour two! March 29, 2021, second hour of the Wofford Peters Show.
Sweet. twice removed.
This arm, I never use it.
Pedro Show, we start off the second hour with Sea Level, doing Easy Four. Then Ben Salter out of Tasmania with Darain. Justice Yeldon, that's Brother Lucas in Sydney, with My Lees. Andy Kerr out of the Netherlands, originally British Columbia, Victoria, the island, big R. OBTR, don't know what that means. Hi-Fi Club with Eugene Chadbourne, brand new, Tumor. Eugene's beautiful cat. Used to play the Electric Rake in Psychobilly, right? And then finally, this is like reggae, but start with A, Egge, from Sea Level.
Yeah.
Now, when do you guys get the name Sea Level?
So during all this time when me and Cody were playing, we didn't have a band, but we were trying to figure something out, right? Like, I was like, you would come over, I would teach you stuff. You would teach me stuff.
Well, we had started a band before Sea Level called Aberration.
Oh, that's right.
And that was our first band that we did gigs with, and we only did maybe two or three gigs, and it was mostly covers. It was a couple originals, and we would switch off. So I would play guitar on the songs that I wanted to play, and Dave would play bass. And then when he wanted to play one of his originals or a song he wanted to play, I would play bass, and we'd switch back and forth, but we were still a power trio.
Wait a minute. If you're a trio, who's the third dude?
The third dude was our friend Nick Van Eel. He was the drummer that we started.
Okay, we got to give him credit. The biggest fuck up the Minutemen did was not having George Hurley at the front of the fucking stage. You know, the last 20 years, I've always put my stick men up front. So let's not neglect. Okay, go ahead.
No, I've always dug that about your live shows. But yeah, our first drummer was Nick Van Eel, and we started that band with him. And then that band just kind of fizzled out because Dave was doing a lot at the time, a lot of different bands, and he was kind of just subbing in different things, and we ended up, that just fizzled out, and then Dave had the idea to start Sea Level.
Right, so I was playing with this other group of guys from my high school, because me and Cody went to different schools, and we were on our way to a gig, and my dad was driving, like, I don't think I could drive at the time, and it was him and the bass player of that group were like, what should we call the band? We're going to this gig. We got to have a name for the band. And they're joking around. They're like, well, you can call it C-Level and Durr, because the drummer's name was this guy named Tom Durr. And everyone, it was kind of like a bit, D-E-R, you know, Durr. And like, so it spelled out Clevelander, right? And we went to the gig. We used that name. And then all those guys went their own ways. And I was at the time like writing a bunch of songs, so I liked the C level. I thought that was a cool bit, so I stuck with it.
Okay. So now, you don't ask the same stick man back into C level.
Yeah, he ended up going somewhere out of state, and I think he's a Mountie now. Like he does some wildlife work.
Mountie, that means Canada.
Yeah.
Okay, now, so you get another stick man, and what, do you still switch off on the bass guitar thing?
No, once we started Sea Level, it was more concise, where Dave had this batch of songs that he had wrote, so he had brought me in to play bass, and he brought a guy named Jay Sparrow in to play drums, and we went down in the basement, and he showed us these crazy songs, and none of them were the same sort of feel. And both of us were just kind of immediately drawn in, because at that age, everyone that was writing songs was kind of writing one style or feel, and Dave had just dropped this batch of songs on us that was all sort of everywhere.
And so how long was it before the first gig?
Man,
maybe two or three months.
Yeah, it wasn't long.
And our first gig was actually at the Grog Shop, which was where we have seen you play several times.
Well,
and
there was actually two Grog Shops, right?
Yeah, it was the later one, the one where it is now.
Okay. Well, the other one, it wasn't far, but it was in much different.
Yeah.
And how was the gig? Was it a success?
The crowd was mild. Like,
there wasn't very many people there, but I think the people there enjoyed it.
Right. We just did our 10th anniversary of the same night, and that night probably had like 10 people, and it was cool.
We call those character builders.
Right, and a lot of those guys stuck around and came back 10 years later when we had, like, the place sold out.
Shows to go you.
Yeah.
But you know what, I have to tell you, even a packed house, it can be a lame gig. You got that many people throwing fucking piss and shit and puke. And I've had some nightmare things. That's why I always ask about those kind of things. I want to play Clean His Hands.
one can tie you long. Now come all you noble fellas, come listen to my song. It is a little ditty and it one can tie you long.
Peter Show. C-Level started that chunk of music with Cleanest Hands. And from Barcelona, Mecánica Clásica with Romero Scorpion. Also from that town, Nielsen, with Around the Village Green. And then in Berlin, but he's from Cecina. Manlio Maresca, great guitar man. He don't use a strap. He goes and borrows a chair so he could fucking hike one leg up on there and just hold it up. Just a trip. Emmanuel Frères with Janelle. 40 Ways from Sunday. Come on, come on. And C-Level finally with A-Pump. Okay, so what about studio stuff? When did C-Level go into the studio?
So probably that same year. Near the end of it, there's this guy around Cleveland. You might have met him. His name's Billy Morris. He's like he's a hair metal guy. He played in he was like a guitar player in Warrant, like in their second reformation or something. And he's one of those guys that was always trying something new. Like he would own a venue and then he would move it somewhere else. He would open a studio. So near the end of 2011, I think we booked some time with Billy and went in and tracked our first couple, our first like half the record. And then we did two things with that, two different sessions. And it was really weird. Never recording before, he didn't know. Well, is this the take? Is it supposed to sound like that? Is that all we do? Are we done? Oh, cool. I guess we're done. And like, it was an interesting environment. Like, it was a more rock and roll than I think studios tend to actually be. You know what I mean? And but do you remember anything else from those sessions?
Nah, yeah, like you said, it was very weird trying to figure out the recording process. A lot of the recordings that we did were live, and it was just us in a room just playing the song like we normally would, and at the end we'd be like, was that good?
and we would get from the producers, it'd be like, yeah.
you're saying, tell me if I'm got this straight, kind of a gig in front of the microphones.
Right, essentially, 100%.
And then there's a joke about producers.
Oh boy.
How many producers does it take to screw in a light bulb?
One.
I don't know. What do you think? Right, you're paying this guy money, and yeah. I've heard some. Now some producers are different. They get very, very involved, and they're like they're part of the trip. But other dudes, it's like, what the fuck? So maybe. And if you've never had any experience, you don't know what it's supposed to be like, right?
Right.
Yeah, so it was very easy for them to just not care what we were doing.
To be fair, we didn't maybe approach it as professional as they're used to either, because we're like, oh.
Yeah, but how are you supposed to if you don't know?
Right.
The learning was by the doing.
Exactly. Yeah. So we definitely learned from that experience.
So you probably didn't want to do that next time you went in the studio.
No, what ended up happening is we met this guy, Kerry Kirchlow from RCR Studios, and he was much more willing to get in the weeds of the thing and, like, really work out the song. And we ended up taking the tracks from, like, the live tracks from there and re-recording, like, vocals and guitars on it and learning how to make a song sound right and how to, like, align stuff and do harmonies and, like, how to take a second take, how to analyze. You know, there's so much of, like, self-analyzation that goes through a recording that you don't realize, you know what I mean? Like, the mythos is, like, you just go in there, you're one-track Brian Johnson, and you knock it out. It's true for some people, but you got to learn how to do that. And, like, so our second go-around, kind of reworking some of these songs, was really that process with a guy who was willing to sit through me fail harmonies for an hour.
Somebody with some patience.
Right. Someone with some patience.
Yeah.
And we've been working with him since.
All right. And his name again?
Kerry Kirchlow from RCR Studios.
Okay, Kerry. Yeah, Mr. Kirchlow, thank you for being so patient and helping to develop some Cleveland music dudes. Look, we're at the end of the second hour, March 29, 2021, edition Watt Pedro Show special guest, Dave and Cody from Sea Level. Hold tight for hour three. March 29, 2021. It's the third hour of the Watt Pedro Show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Watford Pedro Show. Start off the third hour of music with Sea Level doing Funk for Free. Then Sun Ra. For some reason, when I was hearing you guys do that, I thought Exotic Force. Damon Smith, a stand-up guy in St. Louis, turned me on that. Carnival Jones next with that's Crane, you know, from Tragic Comedy and some projects, I think, with the late great Richard Derrick. Bygones Are Gone. Sea Level finally with For Some Account. What about titles? When did it come in with the song, right?
Either post, the last time's post. Cody always dogs me for, like, going in the studio and being like, oh, that's a slow C song. It's out of the key of C and it's slow.
Yeah, when we're recording, a lot of times they'll be saved as, we've had so many songs saved as C song.
What you're talking about, there's like a fucking working title.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right, right.
So usually they come later after the song is more fleshed out.
No, I asked that question because, you know, when I write a song, I have to start with a title, and like fucking nobody I ask does that shit.
It's definitely part of the writing process, right? Like if you have
for
like
me,
a head.
Yeah, it's an anchor, it's a focus. You know, everything's
right,
got
right,
a,
right.
Maybe it's because I'm composing mostly on the bass, so I'm not doing it very traditionally anyway. But I need something to maintain a focus, so I ask people that just to get their fucking trip on it. But tell me the process anyway. Was it like when you guys first started where, Dave, you got the fucking the batch of tunes and then Cody starts tearing at it? Or do you make demos where you write everybody's parts?
Mostly the first way. Like I'll write the tune and present it to the group and be like, I don't know how to make this connect. And like then we flush it out together. Occasionally we'll like jam on a bit and I'll do the opposite. I'll take that thing we came up with, write on it, and then bring it back. But it's either, so far, we've had that A or B process. Like, here it is, let's put it together.
Well, let me ask about a C part. Yeah, is there any Cody songs?
Yeah, occasionally there's been songs that I wrote over the years. And when we very first started the band with our original drummer, Jay, it was kind of a more Minutemen collaborative process where we each kind of would bring in songs and then we would try to work them out for the band, but over the years, the process has turned more into Dave coming up with the skeleton of the song.
I'll tell you five or six times the collaboration process with me and D Boom, where we actually tried to write one line each. One guy'd write a line, here, you write the next line, you write the next line.
That's awesome, because I know some songs you guys sing it like that almost.
Well, yeah, but we only did that, I think it was two nights, or one night mm-hmm. maybe, and the five or six songs came out of that, we never tried it again. Now,
it's
the
a hard
good
process.
Thing about with D Boone is I grew up with him playing, learning. I didn't have to teach him anything. I just play the motherfucker and osmosis. He'd get a part right like that. The only guy close to that, Nels Klein. So I'm wondering, Dave, do you have to teach Cody, or does Cody just pick up on his own trip, like
he,
interpret?
He just picks up on the, like, we've been playing together for so long, and part of you and D Boone's, like, mythos it really resonates with us because we kind of find the same thing, like in a way, like I'll show him the part and he knows what to do, and or he'll know, like, oh, this is this Dave Wack thing, he's gonna try to make sense out of it, I'll keep going until he gives up, and then eventually I win Cody over with a bit.
Okay, here, let me get a little specific of my prejudice. Like, Dee Boone never wrote me a bass line. He let me write all the bass for his songs and my songs. And so how's it work in your band? Because both you guys...
Yeah, well, Dave's never wrote a bass line for me. I remember
there's
one song very early on where he wrote a bass solo. It was not really a solo. It's more like a breakdown where the bass kind of takes the lead.
Right, which
melodic.
One? Yeah, melodic sort of bass solo. And but it was never the actual bass line of the song. It was just that part he had the idea of, okay, it's going to go to this part and you're going to do this thing. But that was the only one time, and that was very early on.
Little melodic break, right?
Yeah.
So most of the time when the Minutemen was getting their songs together, since me and D Boone didn't have to teach each other, right, it was with Georgie, because we... Especially with D Boone, he thought that's what was political about the band, was working the drums in. So he didn't want any, he wanted all the breaks to have, lyrical, huh? Even
right.
though the notes are very short on a drum, he still wanted, so that's where we spent the most time in the song crafting.
I think that's one of the best parts of Georgie's drumming in the band, is it's so lyrical.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
When I show Minutemen songs to drummers who have maybe never heard of you guys, they immediately pick up on how lyrical George plays.
Yeah, really good. And then he, on the other side of that, he also wrote some bitchin' lyrics, especially on Double Nickels. And
for sure.
A Man of Star Fires. Look how I play Forsaken.
raised his hand to his son, did it out of drunken, did it out of drunken frustration, as he raised his hand to his son, did it out of drunken, did it out of drunken frustration, as he raised his hand to his son, did it out of drunken, did it out of drunken frustration, as he. Yeah.
Show last music for this edition, Sea Level with Forsaken. Then from Poland, we had Troop of Troop with Gay. And then Wizard Sleeve, Chrome Intensifier. And finally, Sea Level with AWOL. You know what that means, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
End up in the fucking Who's Cow doing that shit.
Okay. That's all.
Sometimes you have it in your band situation, right, on tour. Well,
right.
What happened? Yeah.
For sure. I've definitely done that once or twice.
Yeah, the other guys probably really appreciate it. So look, during the situation, have you been composing?
Yeah. Yeah, we're actually working on a new record now. We got 9 songs pretty much tracked, and we're recording horns tonight, actually.
Horns?
So, we've been,
horns?
Yeah.
So another dimension for the band.
Right. So we got a...
Here, tell me about that. Because, well, you did a little saxophone, Cody, but mm-hmm. who's arranging the horn parts?
Well, we've had horns on the last 2 records we've done. This hasn't been, like, something that's on every song, but it's usually 2 or 3 songs per record that we feel could use a horn part, and we have a few friends...
Robin Blake Sound Experiment. These jazz guys, this fusion group from the area that I was subbing with on guitar. And we've been just like, until the pandemic stuff, anyone that we're inspired by, we've been like incorporating them in our shows and on our sets, trying to make a scene of some sorts of music that really moves us. And so these guys are really tight, and it's a reggae tune and a funk tune, and it's got these perfect spots for horns. So we reached out to them and sent them the tracks and asked them to put their spin on it. So what you're saying,
way of answering the question, they arrange your own parts.
Yes.
Yes. We don't arrange anything. We just... Sometimes we might hum out something that we hear,
but usually.
We leave it all to the
You wave your hand and say, make it be so.
Yeah.
Right. Well, there's some direction. I gave more direction this time, I think, than I ever did. Like, chord progression and, like, as far as, like, this is going to be a triad rise, and that's going to go to that. Then you take it where it needs to be, and you can decide the harmony bits.
Right.
So it's a half-and-half effort, but they're really going to make it cool.
Then I'll yank my pants down and fire off a rocket. like you were talking about that first experience in the studio and the producer.
Right.
Nowadays, you don't do that. Right? You're self-producer or do you, Mr. Curlo?
It's kind of half and half. Like, he'll tell me when I'm, like, messing up, like, as far as, like, he'll be like, that harmony sounds too dissonant. I'm like, I don't know. Maybe let me try this. So he'll pretty much let me try to get my vision out and, like, spell check when stuff
or like
is
going. Or like an editor.
Right. Right.
Yeah, that's happening. Look, where can people find you on the internet?
So we're at c-level44.com for our website, and then the letter C dash level and Spotify, YouTube.
Yeah, but if they go to your website, there's probably fucking links to that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good enough. Those guys get enough advertising. They don't need that much for the Pedro Show. The one I want to advertise is c-level44.com.
Hey,
why 44?
Ooh, that's a great question.
So 44 has been a number that's kind of followed us, not just as a band, but as friends throughout me and Dave's friendship. It was a nickname that he had for one of his friends in high school, and I might be wrong telling the story, right, but I believe she went to, she served.
Yeah, in the Army.
Yeah, in the Army, and so Dave had wrote this song about how he kind of saw a girl that he knew from high school transition from just a high school girl to, like, a soldier. And so that song was called 44. It was on our original demo. It never ended up making it onto any other albums, so it's not actually around anymore, but the number has just followed us, and it's just kind of always been like our guiding number that we've seen everywhere we've gone, and it's kind of just always told us like we're in the right place, we're doing the right thing.
Here's my take. What's 4 and 4 equal?
8. And what is eight
sideways?
It's a loop. It's an infinity.
Infinity, right. So it's a great fucking number. They love that number, yes. 8 in Asia. I'll tell you, they love it, especially China. Look, when the new album comes out, please get it to me, okay? It's been a big honor to have you on the show. Thanks so much. Keep on keeping on, brothers.
Thank you so much, Wild. We appreciate you.
Pedro's here on the March 29, 2021 edition of Wild Pedro Show. Keep your powder dry.